This is Jeff Blankfort with the April 10th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. On my last program 2 weeks ago, I cited in some detail a front-page New York Times report on the Pentagon and the CIA were opposed to the Trump administration's increasing sanctions on Iran, and more importantly, the fear of what would likely happen to U.S. troops stationed in Iraq and Syria should President Trump follow through on his plan to declare Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps a terrorist organization. Well, it seems when forced to choose between heeding warnings by the Pentagon and CIA concerning the welfare of American troops in the region and complying with the wishes of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the president had no problem in pleasing the latter. And in case you didn't get the message, Netanyahu made it clear in a tweet in Hebrew, not in English, in declaring the IGRC to be a terrorist group, Trump was acknowledging the Israeli Prime Minister requested he do so. Some might consider that an impeachable offense on the president's part. That it occurred the day before Israeli voters would be going to the polls to either vote Netanyahu in for yet another term or oust him to face a number of criminal charges that could put him in prison, as happened to another former prime minister, Ehud Olmert, was a pure coincidence. At least that's what Brian Hook, an assistant to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, told Morning Edition's David Green yesterday morning. Unfortunately, Green did not question Hook about the Pentagon and the CIA's expressed opposition to the labeling of the IRGC as a terrorist group, nor had NPR passed on to the listeners that not inconsequential fact. Yesterday was, as you have heard, was Israel's national election. Fearing a prison term for a number of bribery allegations, Netanyahu called it months earlier, believing it was said that a sitting prime minister could not be indicted and jailed. If that sounds familiar, it should come as no surprise, given Trump's overwhelming popularity in Israel, that throughout the country in the run-up to the elections were giant posters of the two leaders standing together and smiling confidently. As it turned out, Netanyahu guessed right. While roughly getting the same percentage of votes as his rival ex-general Benny Gantz, who is not even remotely a dove, Netanyahu will be able to create a coalition of right parties and religious parties and gain 65 seats and a clear majority in the Knesset. That Netanyahu chose April 9th as the date for the election tells you something about the man. It should come as no surprise. Yesterday marked the 71st anniversary of a massacre at Deir Yassin, a Palestinian village on the outskirts of Jerusalem that was carried out by the self-acknowledged terrorist predecessors of Netanyahu, the arrogant of Menachem Begin and the stern gang of Yitzhak Shamir. More than 100 Palestinian men and women were brutally murdered at Deir Yassin, and some of the survivors were then dragged to the streets of Jerusalem to show Palestinians what awaited them if they did not leave their homes and flee. Both Begin and Shamir would go on to be elected prime ministers of Israel, something one should think about when Israelis and their supporters speak of Palestinian terror. As the polling numbers between Netanyahu and his main opponent, former General Benny Gantz of the new center-right party, Blue and White Party, Titan, Netanyahu went all out in defiance of the world opinion, saying on Saturday that he would annex Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank if he wins another term in office. In an interview with Israeli Channel 12 News, Netanyahu was asked why he had not extended sovereignty to large West Bank settlements, as Israel did without international recognition in East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, both captured in the 1967 war. "Who says that we won't do it? We are on the way and we are discussing it," Netanyahu said. "You are asking whether we are moving on to the next stage? The answer is yes. We will move to the next stage. I am going to extend sovereignty, and I don't distinguish between settlement blocks and the isolated settlements," end quote. Netanyahu. That was intended to attract voters from the smaller, extreme racist parties far to Netanyahu's right, and is more than likely is what produced his victory while putting the last nail on the rotting coffin of the two-state delusion. But today I was planning to talk about NATO, which last week celebrated its 73rd anniversary in Washington. The NATO events surrendered the headlines to other news, but it is an important topic, so we will do that in 20 minutes past the hour. Well, President Trump skipped Mar-a-Lago this past weekend to speak in Las Vegas to the Conference of the Republican Jewish Coalition, where he touted his pro-Israel actions and met privately with his major benefactor, GOP megadonor Sheldon Adelson, and the casino billionaire's wife, Miriam. Adelson, owner of the most widely read newspaper in Israel and currently suffering from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, appeared to be wearing a red yarmulke with a Make America Great on the front with Trump's name on the back. The meeting was held at Adelson's Venetian Hotel, where in 2015 he held two auditions for prospective Republican presidential candidates to measure their stands on Israel. When his first choice, Ted Cruz, was eliminated, Adelson chose Trump and funded him royally. On Saturday, Trump reminded him and his audience how his investment had paid off, highlighting all the things he believes he's done for Israel and Jewish U.S. citizens, while speaking of Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu as if he is their prime minister, which I guess is not too far off. "I stood with your prime minister Netanyahu at the White House to recognize sovereignty over the Golan Heights," Trump said to cheers. "How's the race going?" he asked, referring to Tuesday's Israeli election. Well, Trump has been seen as boosting Netanyahu ahead of the election through the Golan Heights recognition, a high-profile visit to Israel by his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and by sharing a Netanyahu election ad on social media. Trump's most notable achievement, he told the Republican Jewish Coalition, was relocating the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, then ending the nuclear deal with Iran, eliminating aid to the UN organization operating in the Palestinian refugee camps, ending aid to the Palestinian Authority, and his recent recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Syrian Golan Heights. All these actions were on Netanyahu's agenda. "We got you something that you wanted," Trump told the rapt audience. "Unlike other presidents, I keep my promises." Well, just prior to the Israeli elections, the latest 2020 election fault line between Republicans and Democrats, and to a degree among the Democrats, presidential candidates, was Benjamin Netanyahu, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency's Ron Campeas reported. At least five of the Democratic presidential candidates, ranging from the Israel critical to the AIPAC aligned, he wrote, have rebuked the Israeli prime minister just days ahead of his reelection bid, after he pledged to annex Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Beto O'Rourke went so far as to call Netanyahu a racist. "The U.S. relationship is one of the most important relationships we have on the planet," O'Rourke said while campaigning in Iowa this weekend. "And that relationship, if it is successful, must transcend partisanship in the United States, and it must be able to transcend a prime minister who is racist." Pete Buttigieg, the Indiana mayor, and Bernie Sanders also criticized Netanyahu's annexation pledge, while rather pathetically claiming it doesn't make them anti-Israel. The Jewish Telegraphic Agency's Ron Campeas pointed out that, quote, how the Democrats treat Netanyahu is indicative of the emerging Israel fault line within their party between progressives who have become increasingly bold in denouncing the Israeli leader and his hawkish policies and moderates who do not want to give Donald Trump any help in his bid to depict Democrats as anti-Israel. Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, campaigning in Nevada, a key caucus state, told the Jewish Telegraphic Agency that she was unhappy with Netanyahu's West Bank announcement, but also emphasized her pro-Israel credentials. "I'm for the two-state solution. I don't favor what Netanyahu did this weekend," she said. "I don't favor the annexation. I think we should have a two-state solution," end quote. I should point out that when a two-state agreement might have been possible in the late 1980s. During the first Palestinian Intifada, the Democrats universally opposed it. In 1988, when a resolution supporting a two-state solution was on the ballot in San Francisco and was way ahead in the early polls, every elected Democrat from the Oregon border to Mexico was pressed to sign a statement opposing it, and money poured into the opposition's coffers from all over the country, most of which went into slick mailing pieces, one evoking Martin Luther King, another Harvey Milk, another the founding of the UN, and one of Costa Rican President Oscar Arias to argue that calling for a two-state solution was a threat to peace. Arias later told them to stop using his name like that. It was only when Israel's expanding settlements made even a truncated Palestinian state no longer viable that Democrats changed their position. Should Netanyahu go through with his promise to declare Israeli sovereignty over the West Bank settlements, it will no longer be possible for them to defend the two-state fiction that has thinly cloaked their hypocrisy for decades. It is certainty that Trump will support it, which is frightening. Given that Trump is the most accommodating U.S. president that Israel has dealt with yet, it is logical to assume that Netanyahu will try and get away with as much as he can while Trump is in office, which means that annexing at least the major settlement block is more than likely. Yesterday, Mike Pompeo was grilled by a Senate Foreign Relations Committee and three times refused to answer the administration's position on Netanyahu's statement about annexation, which is ominous. That Netanyahu's moves will find opposition in Europe and in the UN is, of course, little concern to Netanyahu, since the United States, with veto power at the Security Council, has been Israel's golden egg. At what point we should begin to wonder, will he kill it? Norman Solomon, who ran unsuccessfully for Congress in our district, has just written an article on Common Dreams, taking to task Bay Area Congresswoman Barbara Lee for giving a boost to our bloated military budget. What Barbara Lee did on the House floor 3 days after 9/11, speaking prophetic words and casting the only vote against a green light for endless war, writes Solomon, remains the bravest wise action in Congress during the century. The contrast was jolting last week, he wrote, when her vote enabled the House Budget Committee to approve a bill with a $17 billion increase in military spending for next year and another such increase for 2021. Because of the boost to the military, three progressive Democrats on the committee voted against the budget bill, Pramila Jayapal, Ro Khanna, and Ilhan Omar. This is a key philosophical moment for our party, Khanna said. The second-term congressman from Silicon Valley told the committee, "We cannot be against endless wars and then fund those wars," end quote. But, in effect, laments Solomon, Barbara Lee voted to fund those wars, plus vast quantities of new weaponry and waste. If she had joined with Jayapal, Khanna, and Omar in voting no, the committee would have been deadlocked with an 18-18 tie blocking the bill. Many Republicans, he noted, voted against the bill because it raises the caps on non-military and military spending. After the committee vote on April 3rd, I requested a statement from Congressman Lee, writes Solomon. She replied, "I voted to advance a bill out of committee that sets budget caps for the next two fiscal years. To be clear, I do not support Pentagon spending levels in the bill and voted for an amendment offered by my colleague, Representative Khanna, to freeze Pentagon spending at 2019 levels. Unfortunately, the Khanna amendment failed," end quote. Lee's statement added, "I have a long record of fighting to cut bloated Pentagon spending, audit the Pentagon, and repeal the 2001 authorization for use of military force," end quote. And she said, "I'll continue to fight for these efforts and to increase domestic discretionary spending as the budget in the budget and appropriations process moves forward." Certainly, Barbara Lee has been a stalwart opponent of endless war, acknowledges Solomon. Her tireless efforts to undo the AUMF have recently included the introduction in mid-February of a bill titled Repeal of the Authorization for Use of Military Force, H.R. 1274. Yet, writes Norman Solomon, there's no getting around the fact that Lee's vote in committee last week made it possible for a budget bill that further bloats the Pentagon spending to reach the House floor. End quote. That bill was expected to be voted on yesterday or today. It was Lee's vote while on the Democrats' platform committee in 2016 that prevented a plank opposing the expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank from being part of the party's platform. On my last program, I described, as did my guest, Dr. Lee Arts, the history of U.S. efforts to undermine the Venezuelan government that preceded the death of Hugo Chavez, and how Juan Guaido came to be anointed by Trump as the country's president. In the days following, NPR carried moving reports by host Ari Shapiro from the Colombian border of Venezuela, of Venezuelans who had fled the country, but nary a word about the U.S. role in the country's plight. What I heard seemed to be justification for another quote-unquote humanitarian intervention by Washington, and another reminder that NPR relies on Congress for its funding. But let's end with some good news about radio on KZYX. Three national programs that are regularly heard on KZYX have stepped up their game, and all can be found on KZYX's jukebox. The one that's been around the longest is On the Media, produced by WNYC in New York and heard on Sundays at 6 p.m. It has been doing an excellent series of thought-provoking interviews on the growth of U.S. imperialism and expansion of the frontier. I heartily recommend it. Two others, Reveal and Snap Judgment, one heard Mondays at 3 p.m., and the other Saturdays at 7 p.m., have just done powerful, extremely moving programs that explore the situation of Palestinians under Israeli occupation. Both are independently produced and not dependent on corporate sponsors or funding from Congress. Now I want to go into a little more of what the comments that have been made regarding NATO by our officials. They had a meeting in the White House, and what they seemed to talk about was the importance of NATO countries, which seemed to be more concerned with the welfare of their citizens than spending money on arms, but that doesn't really work for our officials. For example, we had Mike Pompeo. Mike Pompeo says, now is not the time, said Pompeo, to repeat tired excuses that our citizens don't support increased defense spending or security spending. He expressed exasperation at the argument he hears so often in Europe, which is that his leaders simply will not spend money on defense at anything close to the levels Mr. Trump and before him Barack Obama had in mind. What's interesting is that the Europeans, by and large, even after the U.S. had sanctioned Russia over Ukraine, showed they had no real interest, our NATO nations, in fighting a war on behalf of Ukraine, or in fact, any other European member of NATO who would be attacked by with Germany kind of leading the way. It's kind of an interesting situation because the United States constantly is warned about how the importance and the danger of Russia. We've seen how the U.S. manipulated the situation behind the scenes, spent $5 billion to overthrow the government of Ukraine. I played twice on the air Victoria Nuland's speaking to a Ukrainian-American organization before the Ukraine president was overthrown, that they had spent $5 billion for regime change in Ukraine. That, of course, pressured Vladimir Putin to retake or annex Crimea for Russia, which had historically been part of Russia since the Ukrainian Nikita Khrushchev made a paper change when it was part of the Soviet Union, simply switched Ukraine or Crimea to Ukraine, even though at the time when Khrushchev did that in 1954, it had no real meaning because it was part of the Soviet Union. But since Crimea contained Russia's only warm water port, and according to the change in giving Ukraine the ownership of Crimea, Russia still had access and right to not only use the port in Sevastopol in Crimea, but also stationed 25,000 troops there that were not considered occupying troops. So there were already 25,000 Russian troops in Crimea when the annexation took place. But polls taken not long afterward, what was found in a Pew poll was particularly striking was the reluctance among many of those surveyed in Europe to get drawn into a deeper military conflict with Russia, either in Ukraine or elsewhere in European soil. And perhaps the most interesting finding was an answer to the question, quote, if Russia got into a serious military conflict with one of its neighboring countries, which is a NATO ally, should our country use force to defend it? Well, this relates to a core principle of NATO's founding treaty of 1949, the Article 5, which states that an armed attack on one should be considered an attack against them all, end quote. And this is the prime reason that small countries on Israel's periphery that used to be part of the Soviet Union, the tiny Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, joined NATO, and actually NATO has violated an agreement made with Washington that they would not move its troops to the Russian border where they are at this very moment. Well, the commitment to collective security was a guarantee. They were anxious to secure so they would not find themselves on their own if their fears of possible Russian military interference were ever realized. Yet according to a sample of public opinion in six of NATO's biggest countries in Europe, support for actually implementing this collective security pledge is lukewarm, to say the least. We have not heard that here. We've only heard what the U.S. position is on Article 5. For example, an answer to the question, if Russia got into a serious military conflict with one of its neighboring countries that is our NATO ally, do you think our country should or should not use military force to defend that country? According to the poll, 56% of Americans said they should, and 53% of Canadians said they should. But from there on, it goes down. Only 49% of Britons, 48% of Poles, 48% of Spaniards, 47% of Frenchmen, Italy only 40%, and Germany only 38%. So the idea that the Europeans really support NATO and want to go to, and are worried about the Russians and are ready to go to war again, they who have known war and have had war on their soil, is far less than two countries, U.S. and Canada, who don't know anything about war on their soil in anybody's lifetime. It's quite interesting. And even in terms of placing the blame in Ukraine, in the U.S., blame was placed, 15% was placed on pro-Russian separatists in Ukraine, 30% of the Ukrainian government, 42% on Russia, and 5% on Western countries, and 22% didn't know. Canada was quite similar, but you go down in Germany, only 29% blamed Russia, and that was the same in Italy, whereas the further west you go, the blame on Russia went up. But it's interesting, in the countries closest to Ukraine, the country closer to Ukraine, which would be Germany, although the Poland was very anti-Russian. They have an extreme right-wing government now, which is a number of the right-wing government, right-wing movements are very strong supporters of Putin, which is one of the ironies of European politics these days. But it's interesting, we don't hear this in the United States. We only hear that the Europeans aren't paying enough. These countries, of course, all have strong welfare systems, not only the right to health care, but pension programs. You don't see homeless on the streets as you do in the United States. This is something that most Americans are not informed of, and most Americans who travel there go in tourist spots, but they don't have homeless in the streets of European countries like you see in the United States. But I want to go into a little more about the Israeli election because it is very critical. We have a situation in which Netanyahu has been essentially running the White House. You may have heard a few weeks ago a woman who has written, named Ward, I think Vicki Ward, has written a biography of the Kushners, and she told Amy Goodman that essentially Netanyahu is the Secretary of State. He's running for U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East out of the White House. And this is the case. He's done every single thing that was on the Israeli agenda that previous presidents, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, refused to do. He was allowed to come on the floor of Congress twice, to joint sessions of Congress, while Obama was president, without even having been informed that Netanyahu was going to be coming. And both times he got over 29 standing ovations from the joint sessions of Congress. The second time he came to attack the U.S. Deal, prospective deal with Iran that was also co-signed by the members of the Security Council plus Germany. Israel was against it. The Republicans were against it. AIPAC was against it. Netanyahu was seriously tried to damage it and keep the Congress from approving it. Congress actually didn't get a chance to approve it. It was not that kind of a treaty. But in any case, imagine a foreign leader coming to another country and attacking the positions, the foreign policy of a sitting president. Netanyahu got away with that. There was no outrage. Even supporters of Obama kept their relatively silent within the Democratic Party. A number of people didn't attend that speech, but it was outrageous. Now we have a president. And by the way, it was since AIPAC was unable to stop the nuclear deal, JCPOA, from going into effect. People said AIPAC was not that strong. But in fact, it was strong. What AIPAC was able to do was to get Congress to pass a bill that required the president, any president, to recertify the deal with Iran every 90 days. And that, consequently, is what allowed Trump to pull the U.S. out of the deal, although the deal still exists with European countries who are trying their very best to salvage it and keep Iran from going back to enriching uranium, which they have not been doing. But also the U.S. Re-implemented sanctions that had been removed as a part of the deal by the Obama administration. So now you have the incredible sanctions being placed on Iran, as on Venezuela, and the same as with Venezuela. Any country or doing business with Iran will also be sanctioned. And so since U.S. banks, most money passes through U.S. banks, countries do not want to run afoul of U.S. Treasury Department, which is actually run by people who are very, 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 very close to Israel since the Special Department on Terrorism was established under the Bush administration. One of the fallout of 9/11 that have damaged our civil liberties. It's amazing what one man, Osama bin Laden, could actually do and influence U.S. policy, but I suggest it's a little more complicated than that. In any case, Netanyahu brags about his ability to control U.S. policy. In 1981, he was interviewed in Hebrew, and he said the U.S. is something that could be moved around very easily. 1981, because Netanyahu has been in politics for quite some time. He is now going to be the longest-serving Israeli prime minister. They have a strange situation there where a prime minister can call an election whenever he feels like it. And political parties come and go in the night. You could be in one party one day, another party the next day. It's nothing like the United States. Of course, we're nothing to brag about. But in any case, it's a very dangerous situation because there's no doubt that Netanyahu will take advantage of this situation to fulfill his promise, and he may have even have already talked to Trump about it, of annexing Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He just declared sovereignty, or U.S. just recognized Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights in Syria, which is occupied Syria. Nobody else has recognized that. The United States believes it can tell the world what to do, and so far the world, to a large extent, has let the United States get away with it. And they've allowed Trump to be more of an imperial president than anyone who has preceded him. And this is a dangerous move. The Democrats have allowed this. That's why the 2020 Senate elections may be critical, because Trump has already done enough, aside from any accusations of collusion with Russia, to be called for crimes and misdemeanors that any one of us, if we committed, would be arrested for or certainly questioned by the authorities. But Trump has managed so far to get away with everything, and he's so far gotten away with allowing the Prime Minister of Israel to determine U.S. Middle East policy. And that is very, very scary, because should Netanyahu go ahead and annex these territories for Israel, and the U.S. will recognize them, that's all that Israel needs, because any veto, any resolution in the U.N. to sanction Israel will be vetoed by who's ever the U.S. U.N. delegate in Washington. It's interesting. We have all these acting secretaries. When James Mattis, who opposed Trump's Iran policy, as did the Pentagon, as did the CIA. It's extraordinary you haven't heard it before. Only did I report this, and it wasn't a secret. It was on the front page of the New York Times, and it seemed to have dropped out. But that the Pentagon and CIA are very afraid of what is going to happen in Iraq, because Iran is depending on Iraq depends on Iran for its electric power. The U.S. has demanded that Iraq gets its power from some other source, which is not available. And the Iraqis are rebelling about that. Also, there are members of the Iraq legislature who are very close to Iran and also have connections to the Revolutionary Guards of Iran. And they are now Iran is talking about declaring the U.S. military to be a terrorist organization. And there's more arguments on behalf of that than there is that the Revolutionary Guard is one. You heard on Takeaway yesterday, a one-time respected journalist, Robin Wright, accusing the Revolutionary Guards of every kind of crime in the Middle East, that some were done openly by al-Qaeda. It's amazing the kind of propaganda that we are hearing about Iran, which is very similar to the run-up to the Iraq war. Same kind of lies in the media, and no voices to correct the truth are being heard. Unfortunately, it's the same thing as it was with the run-up to the war in Iraq. And it's not surprising that after the U.S. deposed Saddam, Israeli officials, including one defense minister, Shaul Mofaz, said, okay, you took care of Iraq, now take care of Syria and Iran. They want the United States to do it. They want American soldiers to shed its blood, not Israeli soldiers. None have ever shed a drop of blood for the U.S. But the war in Iraq, I've written about that. You could go online. If you're interested, Google my name, Jeff Blankfort, and then A War for Israel, and you will find an article that I wrote in 2004 that holds up very well today, in which I explain who orchestrated the war on Iraq. And there's been some books written by Professors John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt from Harvard and Columbia and Chicago University, expanding on the issue. But if you want to read my article on that, you will see how very much the cover-up has been accomplished. And unfortunately, President Obama, with an accomplice in Nancy Pelosi, decided just before Obama went into office that there would be no investigation of what happened, the faulty information that was provided about non-existent weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that led up to the war. The British have had 5 hearings to determine how did Britain get into the war, but none in the United States. And sadly, there was no demand for it. And so if we had investigated who was behind the Iraq war, we would have come across the Project for New American Century, mostly composed of pro-Israel neocons who had been appointed by George Bush into the Pentagon, into the White House, and in order to get the information, to create the false information that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, they set up an Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon to create, to fabricate the false evidence. This would have come out in the hearing. It's not a secret. You could find it online. But this should have been an investigation by the U.S. government, by the U.S. Congress. It didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen is because of the power of the pro-Israel lobby in Congress, which is about to get us into another war in Iran. You won't hear a discussion of this subject anywhere else. It's a very dangerous situation, and it isn't being discussed. Our presidential candidates aren't discussing it, and we very likely will have it. Netanyahu is aware of his ability to control Trump. Trump is surrounded in the White House by his ambassador, his son-in-law, the notion that there's going to be some kind of a peace plan that will work, it's like a pie in the sky. It's a Pied Piper thing. Oh, we're going to have this peace plan. Israel may not like it. Believe me, there will be no plan advanced to Israel that Israel will not like. As a matter of fact, this has been going on for how long now? We keep hearing about it. And who is in charge of it? Jared Kushner, the man who is invested in settlements in the West Bank, a former board member until he was appointed by Trump to be his advisor in the Middle East. He was a board member of an organization called Friends of Israel Defense Forces, which every year raises now well over $100 million in tax-exempt dollars for R&R for Israeli soldiers. They have big dinners at the Beverly Hills Hotel that go unreported by the mainstream media. The last one, amazing, in 3 hours, they raised $80 million. $10 million came from Haim Saban. $10 million came from the Democratic Party, an Israeli-American. $10 million from Sheldon Adelson, the biggest donor to the Republican Party. $16 million from Larry Ellison, the head of Oracle, which has a big stadium, owns the Warriors, has a big stadium now in San Francisco. That information does not get into the mainstream media. Because they don't want it in the mainstream media. And the information exists, but you have to look for it. I've talked about it here. You won't hear it anywhere else. But it's really frightening because we have Iran is a nation with five times the number of people they have in Iraq. The appointment of John Bolton, who twice has written op-eds calling for the bombing of Iran, was pushed on Trump to appoint him by Sheldon Adelson, who himself has called for dropping an atomic bomb on Iran somewhere in the desert to let them know we're serious. This man is the same man who you could go on your computer and Google Adelson apologizes for serving in the U.S. Army, and you'll see him speaking in English in 2010 to a group of American Jewish Israelis when he opened his newspaper, Israel Hayom, in which he apologizes for having served in the U.S. Army and not the Israeli Defense Forces. That the Democrats have not used this politically is obviously because they believe it would provoke anti-Semitism. It very well might. But I guess we would rather have a war with Iran and thousands of casualties again and then tread on some people's sensitivities when the Jewish community itself should be attacking Sheldon Adelson. The man has made his billions from gambling in Macau and Las Vegas, and he's as a representative of the human species, no religion should claim and should want to have this guy representing them. But he gets away with it. He gets away with it. A couple of programs ago, I played you an event. You heard on Democracy Now, in which Haim Saban, this Israeli-American, a big funder of the Clintons, by the way, was interviewing Nancy Pelosi and Charles Schumer about just before the election, just after the elections. And Saban was the host, but the whole event was paid for by Adelson because it comes from Republican, Democrat. It doesn't matter when it comes to Israel. And you heard Nancy Pelosi bragging about all the committee appointments she had made that would benefit Israel. Again, this is something that ordinarily, if it was for any other country, would be a cause for an investigation and calling Pelosi on the carpet. But she has been speaking and working for Israel for as long as she's been my member of Congress. Matter of fact, the very first time she ran back in 1987, she was running against Harry Britt, and she was in the Mission District, and she was known for her opposition to the aid to the Contras. People were saying, oh, Nancy's great. She's against aid to the Contras. And I asked her a question at a meeting in the Mission District. Nancy, if aid to the Contras was on the same piece of legislation as aid to Israel, how would you vote? And then she asked the moderator if we could move on to the next question. And he said, no, answer the question. And she said, I would support the appropriation. So obviously she would choose Israel over the Nicaraguan government. That's our Speaker of the House. She now claims to be have been an opponent of the Iraq War. She was mildly critical in the beginning, but as soon as the war was on, she was all for it. So this is the leadership we've got. This is the leadership we've accepted. You heard earlier today, Norman Solomon has written an article. Norman Solomon, who ran for Congress here in our district, who wrote a letter for wrote an article for Common Dreams about Barbara Lee, who's a darling of the Bay Area liberals and the Black Caucus, casting a vote that allowed the committee on foreign relations to vote out and put on the floor a humongous military spending bill, larger than ever in history. And there's no excuse for that. But she will get away with it because the people in Berkeley and Oakland, where she represents, like her and says she's progressive and so on. And this kind of liberal allowing of liberals to vote that way is one of the reasons we're in terrible straits today. The last time I saw Nancy Pelosi was at a press conference, the last one she held in San Francisco before she became Speaker. Was just after Cynthia McKinney had been reelected to Congress in Georgia. Cynthia McKinney, an outspoken critic of Israel, and who also the only member of Congress who publicly questioned the events of 9/11, she had been reelected, but Pelosi was not going to give her seniority back as the Republicans had given the seniority back to another Republican who rejoined Congress after being voted out. And I asked Pelosi, how come you're not giving Cynthia McKinney her seniority back as the Republicans did for this particular congressperson? And she made some stumbling answer. When I pushed her on it, she just walked right out of the press conference. This, of course, was filmed but not recorded on the San Francisco station. So this is what we're dealing with our Democratic leadership. Fortunately, we seem to have, within the Democrat Party, some really young people who are not going to take to play the game and go along to get along as the Democratic Party leadership has. And there's going to be a major fight in the Democratic Convention, I'm sure. And I think it's interesting that my conclusion has been so far that the Democrats would rather lose the election to Trump than lose control of the party to the new young people who are more militant and criticizing the way things have been. People like Ilhan Omar, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, like Rashida Tlaib, like Jair Pal in Seattle, Ro Khanna. There's a number of Democrats, young Democrats, who are not going to listen to the party leaders who are leading them into a desert. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.